As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
If that day were to come, then one can say India has risen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there are different ways to measure power. There can be economic power, military power, and et cetera. Right. And then India, I think, is quite, you know, high up there, right? And then when if the world becomes a multipolar order, and then India probably will be one of the poles, right? However, I feel that as long as India is weaker than China, India will feel like it has never risen.
Absolutely. So Mohan, in his article, he talks about this in the economic integration into the region. I found these numbers to be quite staggering. He said that India's...
Aloha, and welcome to Strategic Voices. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army, retired, and professor. Joined by my colleagues, Professor Sham Takwani and Lami Kim, here at the Daniel K. Inouye, Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. As India approaches the centenary of independence in 2047, a central question looms. What kind of power will India become? India has long prized strategic autonomy, but in today's more competitive and increasingly transactional world, is that autonomy still delivering influence? Or is it now being read as aloofness? In this episode, we examine India's grand strategy, its economy, its politics, and its partnership with the United States, to ask whether this is the decade India claims its great power moment or lets it slip away. Oh my goodness, it's been a while coming, but here we are. How are you guys doing?
Good to be back.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
How are you doing, James?
Oh, I'm doing good. Busy, but after several months of off again, on again, attempts to get this going, we're here. This is episode one. Where you been? What you been up to, Sham? What you been doing?
We were on a shutdown for a while, and so I used that time to catch up a lot on my reading, and kickstarted my finally, after nearly 40 years, my book.
Is this your memoirs, your serendipity that you were telling me about?
Yes, Serendipity to Sri Lanka. I've got some writing done, and I'm committed to submitting the first draft of the book before fall next year. And if all things work out, if the editors are happy, and if I do a reasonably good job, then I should see it in print by 2027.
Oh man, that's goodness. And so this is going to cover your time embedded as a photojournalist with the LTT Tiger?
Yes, it's as an embedded.
1983 you started?
Yes, it started in 83.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me.
I had already finished a first year deployment in Korea when that kicked off, so I'm not trying to date you.
Yeah, so it's been good because I was able to reignite some of the writing skills that I thought I'd totally lost, which I had when I was a journalist. And so I've been writing also a few pieces externally and for our internal in-house publication.
Yeah.
And it's been a great exercise to be able to realize that I can still do some writing.
Oh my goodness. You just wrote chapters for me in a couple books we did this year. And so this, I write is not,
I didn't say I can't.
I know you can.
I just thought it had become very rusty. So actually I should say thank you for bringing those books out because that got me going.
Yeah. Yeah.
The books got me going. And then, the books have a separate style of writing.
Of course they do.
And my stuff is a separate style. And the articles I put out, that's another style. So I'm been trying different styles, and so I think I'll finally settle down just this week, I think, or the weekend on the style I should be approaching my book.
Yeah, no, you told me you wanted to go back to some of your reporting style that you did.
Yes, so absolutely. Absolutely.
How about it, Lami? What you been up to?
Well, yeah, but I just like to mention that I had a privilege to read a chapter of the manuscript. It's really, really well written.
I didn't get to read any of it.
Thank you so much. You're so busy, James. Not that you are busy, like me.
Yeah, so I cannot wait to read the whole thing later.
Thank you, Lami.
I just got back from South Korea yesterday. I'm very jet-lagged today. It was nice to visit the cold briefly, but I'm very happy to be back in Hawaii. I also finished my book. Actually, I finished my book. work, and I just signed a contract today.
Congratulations.
That's what I heard. So who's publishing for you?
The Stanford University Press.
Oh, that's really significant. Good job.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Well, I too traveled. Went for Susan and I. We flew to Texas. That's where our older son and his family are and grandchildren. And we met up for Thanksgiving. We went out to Galveston port. We got on Carnival Cruise's largest ship. It really is large, the Jubilee. Spent a little.
How many people does it take?
Oh, there's six. The crew is about 1,800, and then
crew.
The crew. And then there were about 6,500 passengers. It was, you can do the math. That's a lot of people. This was a very large ship. We spent 8 days there. We went out to Western Caribbean, did a number of things. The fact that high school grandchildren still want to spend time with grandparents is a good thing. And so we had a great time together. So,
did you try any new cuisine?
You know, I am a vegan, so I'm pretty bland in what I eat, right? And so I don't know if that was new, but my son, both of them actually, but only went out with one of them. Such a foodie. Oh my goodness. Cruising is best for him because there's so many food options. But
not to take away from our discussion, but are people being creative about vegan dishes across the world?
Much more so. It is such much more accommodating than it used to be. And so it's all good. So.
Okay.
Sham, you came as we were prepping for this session. In fact, this was kind of your idea. I think most people know. I mean, you are very focused in South Asia, and so this is right in the heart of that. And you sent us several readings, which I have to tell you, I enjoyed. I've even brought some of them here, but Shidig Bajpayee, if I pronounced that right, his foreign policy article on India's strategic autonomy is now reading as aloof. And I found that interesting. I thought it was a really poignant question to ask is, you know, this strategic autonomy, we're kind of not aligned either side, but is it being read as you're just not present, you're aloof? And that's kind of what Bajpayee was asking us, right? And then Siraj Mohan, his foreign policy piece on India and the rebalancing of Asia. And really asking the question, is India underperforming, as a balancer here in the region? And he, you know, lays out some really interesting things, particularly these five broad challenges that that India needs to grapple with as it seeks to have more of a, you know, prominent role in the region. then what did I have? I had Muhib Rahman, if I pronounce that right. That was in foreign affairs, and he's really looking at the illiberal leadership backlash in the region and whether through India's actions there's this backlash that there isn't, you know, not a preferred neighbor as it might be. And then the last one, which was by Hartosh Singh Bal, and this was the staying power of India's Hindu right and the fact that the BJP has staying power even after Modi, and it kind of laid the durability of the Hindu nationalism stuff. So of course I only read these two based on your promptings, but I'm sure this was material that you were quite steeped in. But say more. About this?
Well, for one, I want to allude to something you said earlier. Is this India's moment?
Yeah.
And I think we've been asking that question for the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. So India is a rising power. It's still rising. And I think those four articles, plus a clutch of experts who have been writing for foreign affairs, primarily foreign policy, and even the Indian media, people who really know what they're talking about.
I mean, Sham, you wrote a chapter in the book on India rising and then small states and stuff. So you've been seized with this topic, I know for sure.
Yes. I mean, it's obviously something very close to my heart, and I follow it rather closely. But I think the first thing I want to say is it's not a new phenomenon that, you know, Is it at the cusp of becoming a great power? And I think that's a question that's, in my opinion, I don't think the others are going to jump and say that, but I'd say, in my opinion, it's a question that will haunt us even after 2047, even after India has celebrated 100 years. And I think some of these articles lay out the reasons it's underperforming, primarily, in various sectors. The key thing is, it's apart from its own underperformance and its inability to rise to the occasion, also is a fact you pointed out, which is when you have a neighborhood that distrusts you, that looks upon you with fear instead of someone you could cooperate with, that's also going to be an impediment to your rise. And then if you're going to look at far powers, you know, whether it's the United States or powers like China and Russia, what have you, you can go on beating the drum on strategic autonomy. It sounds great. And I think it's, as a policy, it's terrific, because you don't want to ally with one or the other. But, you know, strategic autonomy can only be credible when others still trust your direction. Because at this point, people see it as hedging without commitment. And if we, for instance, in the United States, see it as hedging without commitment, then clearly we're not going to be able to help India rise. We've been trying in various ways and to make that happen. And India, of course, has its own reasons for not wanting to be seen allied as closely allied with one power versus the rest. But in practice, that's not the case. Mm. There's more lip service to strategic autonomy than reality would, than the evidence, you know, suggests. So I think now, in an era of sharpening blocks, you know, ambiguity is no longer cost-free. And India's ambiguity is no longer cost-free. It comes with a cost. And partners don't ask India to choose sides. They ask it to show up predictably. And so, bottom line, I would suggest is, India's ambition is real. To go back to what the title of our top conversation is, which is India's strategic vision. Can strategy match ambition? I would say India's ambition is real. Its strategy is very fragmented. Mm. And I would say its domestic trajectory, which is very, very, very often either ignored or understated in all foreign policy discourse, or even India's efforts to rise as a power, which is why I added that article by Hartosh Singh Bal, which talks about the staying power of India's Hindu right, because that's often ignored for whatever reasons. And I think it's important to understand that India's domestic trajectory is actively undermining its external vision. So I think that's important to highlight. And finally, I would suggest that India's pursuit of strategic autonomy, it's not matched by its material capabilities or alliance behavior. Those two are very critical. It's leaving it weaker than its ambition suggests. So I would say, great powers, if you're talking about becoming great powers align. They align means, institutions, and narratives. All three have to be equally aligned. But in India's case, it has ambition without manufacturing depth. Number two, it has diplomacy without deterrence capability. And finally, it has partnerships without prioritization. And I think that's, and I go back to saying strategic autonomy doesn't come cost-free. Ambiguity doesn't come cost-free. Mm.
Mm. Well, there's a lot to unpack here, and we'll definitely go back to strategic autonomy and flexibility. But just to, you know, first thing that I wanted to, you know, talk about is, you know, regarding the question of is whether India has risen or will rise, hasn't it already risen? I mean, you know, India is expected to overtake Japan as the third largest economy soon, right? At a certain point last year, I think that India was the third largest economy. And also, according to Global Firepower Index, India has become the fourth largest economy. It has nuclear weapons. And so, I mean, of course, power is relative, and then India is competing with China. And so in comparison to China and some other countries, India might be weaker, but India is, I mean, I think that we should give India a little bit more credit.
I love that question you just asked. Is it rising or has it risen? It reminded me tangentially, finished Dan Wang's book, Breakneck. I don't know if you've seen that one. It's a very popular book out right now about China is a country of engineers, the United States of lawyerly class. And so, but he asks a question which is quite similar to what you just asked. And he said, China says it will perpetually be a developing country, and the United States is, you know, is a developed country. Mm-hmm. But if you look at infrastructure between the two countries, China has significantly some more developed and modern infrastructure. Some of the United States is a lot more older. And he says, perhaps the right thing is we should always be developing and we don't actually ever arrive because there's so much to keep doing and not sit on our laurels saying we've
Which
achieved.
Which was going to be arrived. My question to Nani. India's already risen. Risen to what? When we speak about it as a rising power, rising to what? So what's the benchmark that we're looking at when we speak about it being a rising power, rising to what?
And so to your point that they're always rising, I think I would argue that's probably good. They ought to continue to always be seeking and rising.
Absolutely so. But I think some of the commentators see it as, when I go back to this question, if you speak about rising to what, risen to what? So if I were to throw the question at you, you'll have your responses. But clearly, the commentary suggests it's rising or risen to be a world superpower.
So I don't think it's ever going to see itself as a superpower. Great power, but maybe
great
not
power.
A superpower.
Okay. Great power, allied, you know, along the lines of China, the United States, and India. So when we speak about it, India being a rising power, risen power, clearly commentators think it's these three powers can sit on the table and be treat each other equally. So that would assume if that day were to come, then one can say India has risen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are different ways to measure power. That can be economic power, military power, and et cetera.
Right.
And then India, I think, is quite, you know, high up there, right? And then if the world becomes a multipolar order, and then India probably will be one of the poles, right? However, I feel that as long as India is weaker than China, India will feel like it has never risen.
Absolutely.
So Mohan, in his article, he talks about this in the economic integration into the region. I found these numbers to be quite staggering. He said that India's trade partnership with ASEAN states last 23-24 was $121 billion. That might sound like a significant number. China with ASEAN was $1 trillion. That's a magnitude order difference that is significant. And so there is a lot of growth. You spoke about them rising to be the third largest economic power, displacing Japan. Mm-hmm. But you could see there's a huge delta between number three and number two, right?
Well, going back to Nami's point, yeah, you can become the second largest economy too. And there are various kinds of power. But is anybody talking about the inequality in India? And that's huge. So I mentioned that earlier, which is, you can't ignore what's happening domestically.
Yeah.
You can talk about all kinds of, policies and efforts to rise to become that power which can share a table with two superpowers or two big powers. So in some ways, yes, you can say India's rising and becoming the third largest economy and all that. But let's look at what's happening to its manufacturing. There's a much touted program. We want to be self-reliant. How far is the distance between aspiration and reality? Self-reliance, for instance.
Yeah.
So India's one thing never short of hype. They can really hype it up. They can really tell a story. And I think that's one of the pitfalls for people who are not very familiar with the country. It's easy to be taken in by that hype simply because if you're going to say, look, India is the third largest economy and all the hype that follows, they don't correlate really. There are other factors that will stymie India's rise to that position. So I would be very cautious about all the claims that come out from there. Mm-hmm. So that's one. And the inequality is huge within the country. And then you also have majoritarian politics, which you're looking at a population of over 200 million of India's population that's been marginalized. And then you have a neighborhood that's given the dynamics of India with the neighborhood, that definitely is going to, you know, at least provide a major impediment for India's growth. India is not going to be able to rise without the subcontinent rising along with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, some of the arguments then are because of the things you've described and some other things, that some of the other powers, perhaps regional states, are balancing against India because yep. they're concerned of some of this overreach. And whether we're talking about Maldives or...
But I always maintain that India has actually ceded space for another power to come and be around when somebody wants them. I mean, until I would say... the turn of the century.
If that day were to come, then one day the country was
most mm-hmm. of these.
Yeah, I mean, there are different ways to measure power, now, economic power, military power, and etc.
Right,
and then India,
reasons,
I think, is quite high up there, right? And then when if the world becomes a multipolar order, and then India probably
the
will be one
just
of the poles, right? However, I feel that as long as India is weaker than China, India will feel like it has never really.
So Mohan, in his article, he talks about this. In the economic integration,
a lot of the
region,
powers really.
I found these numbers to be quite staggering.
They are.
You said that
they find themselves in a
India's,
position where they don't actually want to choose, right?
Yeah.
They're not asking, you know, it doesn't matter who the choice is with, choosing India, choosing China, choosing the United States, because perhaps they see that as limiting the other options that they may have if they in fact choose.
Yeah, so the other thing I want to keep emphasizing to our listeners and everybody who's reading stuff about India's greatness and rise, I keep on reiterating the fact that most of the discourse does not talk about India's internal issues. And I think that's something that one should pay close attention to simply because I think domestic illiberalism, it's a strategic liability. It's a liability in the long run. It's not an internal matter. Do not see, I mean, India likes to say it's an internal matter, but not that I'm saying we go and poke our noses into what's going on, but it definitely is a strategic liability.
I mean, it perhaps reverberates in some of the other predominantly Muslim states, rather, within the region,
yep,
right?
Yep.
They see that as, and then take deep umbrage to
Absolutely.
What's happening.
And rightfully
domestic,
so.
Yeah. yeah. And mm-hmm. so that... You know, that then has an impact on their ability to influence in the region if domestically they're, you know, having challenges. And, you know, Mohan talks about that as domestic.
Rajamohan.
Yeah, that's right, Raja.
But I was just wondering, I mean, the argument that he makes is that, you know, because of India's disregard for democracy and human rights in the South Asian countries, they are... You know, there is a strong domestic grievances, you know, toward India. And then now they are collaborating with China to, you know, balance against India. I'm not really sure. And I'm curious to hear about your thoughts on that, because if that's the case, if India's disregard for human rights and democracy is the key factor here, then is aligning with China, you know, which doesn't really respect for democracy, human rights, you know, a good option. You know, based on my interaction with our fellows from the region, my understanding is that, of course, I'm not an expert in this area, but my understanding is that, you know, in the problem is not really about this democracy thing, but rather that India was a sole superpower in the region and that they were all too reliant on India. And so when China was becoming influential in the region, they see China as a sort of alternative option, you know, to sort of weaken the sort of hegemony of India. So what do you think?
No, you got that right. So there are two things here. As we speak, there's more lip service paid to democracy and liberalism in the region. Even I include the smaller countries also. And it's convenient, number one, for everyone to talk about that. But again, the way democracy is defined in the region is very different to the way we define democracy in the rest of the world. And just to a good degree, democracy there means being able to run elections every 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's electocracy. But again, beyond that, that really is not a factor that deters or inhibits the smaller countries from looking to China. And the bottom line is, who can treat us, not necessarily as equals, but respectfully? Mm-hmm. That's one. Number two, and I'm not saying that in order of priority. Number two, who can give us money? Who can give us infrastructure? Now, India doesn't have the deep pockets. And not having deep pockets, it's also very successfully alienating the smaller neighbors. So now you have a larger neighbor who has deep pockets, who's also not poking his or her nose into your affairs on how you should write your constitution or what you should do and so on and so forth. So given those two facts, and the third one obviously is democracy. It's all good to talk about, but in practice, the lesser number of institutions that are free to enforce democratic norms, the better, the less. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it was but very natural for them to gravitate towards China. Hey, if we were in the region, they would have gravitated to us. But again, tyranny of distance. And plus, we have our hands full with too many things. We're the world's policemen and all that stuff. But within the region, if anybody, even if it was not China, if anybody had that approach to the neighborhood as well as deep pockets, they'd have switched over there.
Mm-hmm. I thought about how India's strategic autonomy is visible in, you know, Prime Minister Modi's recent interactions. We just go back to late August, early September, and there was a two-day Shanghai cooperation organization, right? And so this was, what is it, the 25th year of this, and it's the fourth time China has hosted it. And when you look at the, you know, the reels, the coming out of that, I mean, it is Modi giving bear hugs to Putin and glad handing with Xi. And so there's this, you know, real engagement. And then just the beginning of this month in a two-day, you know, summit. And this was like the 23rd annual summit with India and in Russia. And Putin is there in India and they're making, you know, agreements and deals. And we'll see whether it happens. It was supposed to happen this year, but Modi is supposed to welcome the Quad members in for the leader summit. Maybe to be pushed off into 26, but this is Modi coming together with, you know, three great power leaders around the, and many other as well. Thoughts? What do you think, International?
Well, there's a combination of two factors here. There's one is signaling. And they're signaling to the rest of the world, including us, that, you know, we still have friends and we will follow our path, which is strategic autonomy. We're still going to be friends with Russia. We're still going to do business with them. So that's the optics. And all the deals that were spoken about and all that, if you look closely, there were no deals to speak and to write home about. It's largely true with optics. With China, and it's quite irksome to be hearing people write and say that the US is responsible for pushing India closer to China and to Russia, which is nonsense. It doesn't really work that way. India, for its own well-being,
will want to make amends with China, will want ties with China. India's economy is pretty closely tied with China's. So there's no, whether we are, there's no way that India is not going to try and make amends with China. It has to, for its own well-being, for its own survival.
Yeah.
And like Lamy pointed out earlier, it's never going to be in a position where it can sit across China as an equal. And to the best of its ability, India has to manage this relationship with China. So to suggest that India's closeness, not closeness, but India's efforts to mend bridges with China was a result of the U.S.'s behavior with India currently, it's not entirely true. Mm-hmm. And I would say it's absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. Forget the word entirely. And with Russia, yes, they had to reiterate the point that this was, I think, Putin's first visit after the Ukraine conflict, first travel abroad, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's great optics. Putin wants to show us and the rest of the world that he has a friend and partner in India, which is a rising power, a risen power. And India has to demonstrate, hey, we are friends, no, notwithstanding how whatever other people might say about us, whatever other people might tell us to do or not to do
yeah.
with our partnership. So there's a lot of optics there.
Yeah, on all sides, right?
Yeah, on all sides. Yeah. Everybody's signaling, everybody's messaging.
Yeah.
But I just want to hammer on the point that for those of you out there who still think that the U.S. has driven India into Russia and China's arms, that's balderdash. That's mm-hmm. That's not accurate reading of the situation.
Yeah. Mm. Well, so I wanted to ask this question or discuss this question of then is, you know, strategic autonomy or flexibility working, right? I mean, I think that, you know, Putin's summit with Modi was, I thought it was much more substantial than just optics and signaling, because the deals that they made on economic cooperation and military cooperation and even like nuclear energy cooperation, I think that's really long-term thing, especially nuclear cooperation, you know, is a very long-term, very sensitive and strong relationship. What is most striking to me is, you know, Russia's agreement to localize military production, defense industrial base in India, technology transfer. And so those things were, you know, quite, you know, disappointing, I think, from some Americans, especially, you know, many Americans, you know, try to win India off of Russian weapon supply.
So just to address two of those things. One is transfer of technology and sharing and co-production. It's not new. Mm-hmm. They've been doing it for a while. The BrahMos missile, for instance, mm-hmm. to the extent it's co-production, it's done in India. To the extent that India is exporting these missiles to the Philippines and Indonesia and Vietnam are probably likely to be the next customers. But the fact is, after Ukraine, the production has slowed simply because Russia is not able to supply the parts and so on and so forth. So that's a continuum. Yeah. That's not new.
Yeah, it's not new. But however, you know, when the United States expected, you know, the military cooperation sort of dying down, now at this moment it's just expanding, that is... Quite
well, the second thing, factor to that is when I said it's more optics, what I had in mind was there was this big hoo-ha about India buying more weaponry and they were putting out all the hardware.
They're buying less. Yeah, yes, significantly yes. less from Russia than they used to. They're about 33%. Where that high was maybe 75 or
so. Yeah, but so what happened was the whole thing, at least in certain sections of the media, there was expectation that India is going to be signing new contracts for new weaponry and getting more new stuff. None of that happened. Mm-hmm. So I had that in mind when I mm-hmm. said it was more optics. So what else, all the other agreements, again, most of them are really not new. Most of them are continuums.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the larger question is, okay, you've all made these... statements and assurance, how much of that is going to be carried out? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always very important. So every summit when they have big powers talking, they make proclamations. Mm-hmm. They talk about this was agreed, that was agreed. It's interesting for us to see the next few years how much of that mm-hmm. becomes real.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what is new and I think is probably going to continue is India's heavy procurement of oil from Russia. So before the February 2022 invasion of Ukraine, India was procuring, you know, around 2%, not a lot of oil. And that is demonstrably changed now, right? And so it is a good deal. It's a better price than the friendship price they used to get under their 1971 Treaty of Friendship. I mean, this is good stuff. And they're not the only ones, in the region. I mean, Japan and South Korea are big LNG procurers from Russia. And obviously, without even saying, China is a massive consumer. But its consumption of oil from Russia, in fact, that caused some consternation in Washington. I remember when it first came about, and it's probably in 22, or I was talking with a senior U.S. person, and I thought, isn't this a problem? And the person suggested, well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. What if, the United States thinks that procuring this oil takes it off the market for China? And I thought, I wonder if that's right. And maybe over time it was, but it certainly isn't the current policy of where the U.S. thinks India should be in its procurement of oil. But that, of course, is a point along this path.
Yeah, so that is related to the question of whether this strategy of autonomy working, right? India's purchase of India's purchase of Russian oil is sort of negatively affecting India's relationship with the United States. And also, just as India is trying to expand its economic relationship with the UK and the EU, this recent summit, I think that could also undermine India's efforts to expand its cooperation with European countries. And so India trying to, benefit from many different relationships. If it works, it's great. However, I think that the world is becoming increasingly bifurcated between the West and the United States on the one hand, and China, Russia, and Iran, maybe, others. And so is the, space for maneuver sort of narrowing for India?
Well, I think India's, they call it strategic autonomy, and sometimes you hear them talking about multi-alignment and diversification, etc. So I think what is necessary to remember is diversification. It demands constant recalibration, constantly. You can't just say, okay, I've diversified and that's it, because like you pointed out, it's dynamic. Things are changing so rapidly. It's defense spending. It's not great. And finally, trade-offs.
Yeah.
It provides less deterrence than alliances. India's diversification plans. So I would just add that India wants autonomy. And I think this is why I would agree with Bajpai, is it wants autonomy without paying the full insurance premium. Mm-hmm. And this is, we're talking about incompatible defense platforms. We're talking about limited tech transfer, as well as diluted deterrence. So I think it narrows its options.
I think about when you say, so here we are, multi-alignment, strategic autonomy, why here and how did we get here kind of thing. And so, we've talked a couple of times about India's independence. And that's in 1947. But before that, during the Second World War, British India is heavily involved in deployment of forces to fight in the Second World War. And they have that as an experience. I mean, we're all shaped by our experience. And they come out of that, and they actually play a significant role in the armistice there in Korea, that the war that from 50 to 53. And so in 53, they stand as the chair of one of the three commissions, and that's the Neutral Nations Repatriation Commission. And so they're the chair, and you've got on the one side Poland and Czechoslovakia, and on the other side Sweden and Switzerland. And they do a good job in this effort of trying to bring about the repatriation, which was quite contested. But coming out of that, it seems as if though there's a bit of a change. And they join the non-alignment movement, right? And so, and
one of the co-founders, yeah,
yeah, yeah, 1955, and there in Bando, Indonesia, where the conference is. And so, and that goes on for some time, but then they run into challenges because you got the 1962 war with China, and things don't go well for India. And then the Cold War is just you know, making everybody pick sides, right? And so they kind of align up with Soviet Union. 1971, sign a treaty of friendship and cooperation, right?
Yeah, peace, friendship, cooperation.
Peace, friendship, yeah, August, peace, friendship, and August of 1971. 20-year agreement that takes you until just before the fall of the Soviet Union in December. But even in August of 91, they renew the treaty. And then, of course, they had to sign a new one a couple years later in 93 with Russia when they are the sending power. And they continue with these relationships. You've talked about some of them that and maybe the last one signed in 2010 or so, but they've had a series of agreements. But as they make choices to try to say, how do we navigate in this complex world? I mean, you run through a period at the end of this Cold War and United States kind of rises as a unipolar power, and they make choices that, it's in this period here that the United States is actually going to warm up to India, and part of it is because they can see them playing off against China, and then you end up with the 2005 civil nuclear agreement, and all these different things are shaping them to find here in this multi-alignment strategic autonomy, because I guess they kind of think that this will give them the most latitude. But then, of course, Vajpayee is saying, not enough to be autonomous if it's at the risk of being aloof and people see you as being irrelevant. And if you're irrelevant, then, in crisis, perhaps you're uncertain. Maybe we think that your ambiguity means that you're unwilling to accept costs, or your hesitation means you're not going to commit political capital. And so these are all real risks. And so when those things happen, then perhaps there's slower access. You're the last one to get intel, cooperation, or tech transfers, or you're lower on people's priorities, or you just have reduced influence. And he kind of lays that as the cost of all of this. What do you think, Lani? What do you think?
Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, we'll come to you first.
Yeah, no, I sort of agree with that argument. And I think that, strategic autonomy comes with some costs. And especially when autonomy is not even working very well, and I think that the cost will be greater.
Well, I think a case should be made for strategic autonomy. It's a good policy, especially, in a way, you're hedging on your bets. But if you look back, when we look back at August 1971, when India signed the Indo-Soviet Union Peace Friendship, what drove that was the fact that it was on the eve of the creation of Bangladesh.
That's right.
A couple of months before, but it was leading up to that. And so we saw in 1971, you have Pakistan, which is very closely allied with China. And then from India's perspective, and under Nixon's time, during Nixon's time, Washington was close to Pakistan. Yes. And therefore, India saw its border in trouble. So it couldn't ally with Washington. There was no way it could ally with China simply because it was 9 years after the war.
Yep.
And who's around?
Soviet Union
and large neighbor, etc. And also you have to remember that India was quite influenced even after independence towards a socialist form of government.
Yeah.
So it drew a lot of inspiration for its ideology, etc. from the Soviet. Not that it went word by word. It tailored it for the Indian population and Indian conditions. So it was, and they had no choice but to turn to the Soviet Union then. And then, of course, what happened after that? Relations with Washington were not great, and it went on until the late 90s when India lit up its nuclear device. It soared further. But then there were a couple of things that were happening simultaneously. India's economy was opening up. It was becoming a big market, rising power, large economy. That was important. And number two, we needed to find somebody in the region to
counter China.
To counter China.
Yeah.
So, and so we were interested in, you know, making up with India. But 2005, they signed the treaty, and then India figured out, look, we need the United States. If you want to really rise, we're not going to be able to do it just with Russia alone. Because in the United States is the most powerful, richest, technology, et cetera, et cetera. So it made sense for them to reassert their non-alignment doctrine as strategic autonomy, what have you. And that continues today. The fact of the matter remains that after 2005, there was a big shift, even in Indian mentality, towards the United States.
Yeah. They accepted their nuclear program.
And historically, India has always been wary, following the 1971 incident, of allying itself with the United States. It's never been seen as a trusted partner for various reasons. And there's not enough, it wasn't enough just to be closely allied with the Soviet, with the Russia. It was not really going to make India rise. It was
no, and particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was, they knew they had to reach out, but they weren't the only one aligned to the Soviet Union that had to find other
precisely
ways.
So
of,
this was by way of just basically saying it serves a purpose, strategic autonomy. And I was just giving you a backdrop,
this
a bit long
now,
on why India is choosing this back, I mean, this strategic autonomy. But I think it's, its ambition is being really hindered by India's, I think they may need to redefine what do they mean by strategic autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly do they mean? Just not to be seen as a vassal or a junior partner to a power? Is that what you're talking about?
Right.
I'd be curious to know, because I mean, and each of these writers will tell you it's this, it's this, it's that. But I think whatever the reasons might be, I think it's very easy to adapt. Like, that's why I went back earlier, you need to recalibrate. You can't have a policy like strategic autonomy and not recalibrate it. You can't etch it in stone.
And
I think that India is having a hard time recalibrating that concept. And I think they've heard enough from everybody that you're not predictable, you're not there when you're needed, etc., etc. It's been a long time that they've been hearing this, and I think it's, if they can't recalibrate this concept of strategic autonomy and at least match their ambition with actions,
right?
I think that's what is missing.
Yeah, maybe, you know, to become a truly, I mean, true, like, great power, then maybe, you know, India will have to think about whether this strategic autonomy aloofness will get India there, right? Just to become a more responsible member of the international community, you know, just contributing more to regional and global security, that might actually get India to, you know, the place that it wants to be.
You mean aloofness will get India?
No.
Just not being
aloof and engaging and contributing to regional and global security.
Yeah. Absolutely so.
Any closing thoughts on this, Sean?
Well, I can be blunt. And I just think no country can become a great power while fighting itself internally.
Yeah.
You must be tired of me talking about the internal situation all the time, but I think that's a very significant factor, which very few people are willing to address. Then you're first of all fighting internally, you're alienating your neighborhood, and you're hedging your most important partnerships. That's not strategy, it's drift. So if India wants its grand vision to survive contact with reality, it must choose discipline and recalibration, as I mentioned earlier, over symbolism. India is very high on symbolism. I said earlier, it's high on hype, it's high on symbolism. And it should choose cohesion over comfort, get it off its comfort zone to to recalibrate its strategic autonomy. So I think history rewards those who align ambition with capacity and punishes those who don't. And I think that's another focus that India has to expend energy on, its capacity. It doesn't have the capacity.
Why?
Yeah, well, I don't want to open up a whole new discussion, but, you know, India-US relationship, I mean, is under sort of a, you know, quite a bit of strain these days. However, the national security strategy that just came out, you know, made me, you know, a little bit more optimistic than I was before. I mean, still that NSS recognizes India as an important player in the region.
I think there never was a doubt about it. Mm-hmm. And yes, we're having an interesting phase right now. But then, like all relationships go through phases.
Yeah, that's true. But 50% tariffs on Indian goods, and then India's unwilling, you know, unwillingness to make compromises on oil, Russian oil purchase, and agricultural market opening, and stuff like that. So, you know, how hopefully the two nations that are, you know, naturally important partners could, you know, narrow their differences and enhance their relationships.
Well, just to address a point there, I think India is making those concessions. The only problem with India is it can't make them public because it would go against its political longevity. That's a fear. Mm-hmm. The fact that, oh, India has finally succumbed to the pressure of the Americans, and that won't play well. At least that's how it's perceived by the establishment. Yeah. It won't play well with the domestic constituency. But believe you me, India is making those concessions behind the scenes. It can't come out openly and say we're doing this simply because they fear that it won't sell well.
Yeah, always domestic politics makes it complicated.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Oh. Well, this has been good. Let's transition. Let's talk about now the region perhaps, or other issues a little bit more broader. And let's talk about the wins and woes that we saw over the last little bit. Who wants to start off?
You want to go first?
Well, the wins, I think the fact that both Nepal and Bangladesh have set dates for the elections, and both these countries had the Gen Z revolution one a few months ago, one a year and a half ago. And the fact that, and now whether how those elections are going to go is it's a different issue. The fact that dates have been announced and they're gearing up for an election, it goes back to what we're speaking about democracy earlier. I think I see that as a silver lining. In other ways, quite a dark cloud looming over the subcontinent. And that's I think, a win. And the other one was Sri Lanka. They had the recent devastating cyclone.
Yeah, they did. Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the wins was how the international community stood up.
Yeah.
Every countries you'd normally not think of, they all stood up. And Sri Lanka is really, I would say, they're pleased to know that people care. So I think those are the three wins, I would say. Two elections and Sri Lanka's recovery. It's going to take a while, but it's a good start for a recovery.
That's goodness. Mm-hmm. Mommy.
Oh, well, I would just mention one. On December 3rd, South Korea celebrated the first anniversary, the one-year anniversary of Yoon Suk-yeol's martial law declaration. South Korea went through rough patches until Yoon Suk-yeol was, you know, impeached and arrested, and then finally ousted from power. South Korea, for about 4 months, went through really chaotic moments. But finally, you know, President Lee Jae-myung was elected, and some people like him, others don't, but still, you know, South Korea now is stable. And I think that South Koreans deserve huge credit. You know, they are the ones who really stopped the martial law declaration and defended their democracy. And so I wanted to recognize that.
And you were just there, the atmosphere, how did it feel?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I think the South Koreans are very relieved and things are going into the right direction. And from a foreign policy perspective, that's, you know, that communities, you know, people that I work with and engage with. And I think that they are mostly very happy that South Korea is back in the global stage and they're making, you know, good contributions. And so I think that they are pretty, you know, elevated, especially with a recent summit with President Trump, and that they got a very good trade deal and the nuclear power submarine deal and stuff like that. Yeah. And so the mood was pretty positive.
That is goodness. Well, the win I wanted to bring was early last month, November 7th, Secretary Hegseth had released a new acquisition transformation strategy. So he gave a long, I don't know, 70-minute or so speech at the National War College, laid it out. And it matters because it's finally a start from the right premise that acquisition is a warfighting foundation. It's just not, an afterthought. And there is real effort that is appears to be being put after that. And if I were to say that there's one organizing principle behind this, it is that speed over process. And so kind of thought about this is think fast. And so F is in faster delivery. So they're looking at 85% solution now, and they'll iterate later. This, of course, was, it reminded me of how, I was reading the Freedom's Forge, and this was a principle in the Second World War. They would, when they tried to get a perfect product, it just slowed down. But when they got it out and then they would iterate it over, they were much quicker. The other one was authority to act, and that's the A. And so they're creating these portfolio acquisition executives that have a larger portfolio where that can move money and set priorities and try to make actions more effective in under their purview. The S is for streamlined and commercial first, and they're looking at more commercial off-the-shelf acquisitions and agile contracting solutions. And then the T for in fast is treat industry as strategic. And so the defense industrial base is a warfighting asset, and they're moving in that direction. And so the strategy is about being fast because, in the modern deterrence, speed is in fact strength. And so one last shout out I'll give to General Evan Lamar Pettis. And so last Friday, he assumed command of U.S. Southern Command, and Lamar and I were colonels together many years ago, and he was the deputy J3 at USFK, and I was the secretary of UNCMAC, United Nations Command Military Armaments Commission, and so I know he'll do a good job, and so hats off to Lamar. So, woes. Let's go back.
Woes.
Over to you. It's not going so right.
The first woe, I have two. The first one is the session went off too fast. We never really got around to unpacking so many things that I had to say. So that's the first woe. The deeper woe is the books by my bedside. I have a list of books, and these books date back to between 60 and 90 years. I was writing a piece recently on Gen Z and the Age of Revolts. So I thought, let me go back to a book I read long ago in school. A Clockwork Orange. I don't know if you've read that or seen the movie, Anthony Burgess. And it talks. So, yeah, I had to read that book when I was writing my piece. And I don't know what happened. That book led to The Iron Heel by Jack London. That's another. And all these are dystopian books. Okay. So there was Clockwork Orange. There was Iron Heel, Fahrenheit 451. That's one. And then Arthur Koestler's book, Darkness It Known, George Orwell, 1984, Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. So these six books, they're enough to squash the spirit.
Sounds like a good problem to have, is to be able to read so much.
And right now, dipping into the father of all the dystopian novels, a book called We, the author was Zamyatin. It's basically, I think, the foundation of Huxley's Brave New World, Orwell's 1984. I think if you read that book, it was written in 1920-21, you've read them all.
Yeah. Sham, even in your blessings, you find reason to complain. Okay. Lami, over to you.
Yeah, so sadly, a Hong Kong court recently convicted Jimmy Lai, pro-democracy media tycoon, of foreign collusion, citing as evidence his lobbying with American politicians in order to stop China from enacting the national security law back in 2020. And he's 78 years old, and if you know, the sentencing, I think, has not occurred yet, but he's expected to be sentenced to life imprisonment. And it is really sad. You know, I taught at the University of Hong Kong. I actually left Hong Kong a week before the national security law was enacted. And it is really, this has been a concern, you know, since then, you know, that, you know, people like pro-democracy activists would face severe punishment. And then now is, you know, realize. And so it is really, really sad. Mm.
I want to pull on my woe actually comes from South Korea as well. And not only did they just celebrate a year after the martial law, on Monday of this week, the special counsel team on insurrection and foreign aggression said that former President Yoon Suk-yeol had directed abnormal military actions starting last year against North Korea, trying to, you know, incite them into responding to create this pretext for maritime, for martial law. And so according to the findings, Yoon had coordinated closely with the then defense minister and chief of the counterintelligence command. And looking at some of those digital notes as evidence, this is some things that they said. The enemy must act first. A wartime situation or a situation uncontrollable by police power must arise. Targeting that leaves no choice but to respond due to the loss of face. And this is really disturbing. And so the plan failed not because they didn't act, they did, but because North Korea chose not to take the bait and to respond. I mean, this is recklessness, and we should hope that it's not repeated.
But James, I think I get the trophy for the best woe. How many people can complain in the, you know, with so much blessings?
That's what I said. I mean, you've got a good one there.
How many people can complain with all the blessings around them? I get the trophy for the best woe.
Well, this has actually been a wonderful hour together. And so,
well, I hope you're going to come back soon.
We are.
Sooner than later.
So, from all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining Strategic Voices. Be sure to join us again next month for our next live show. For Professor Sham Taquani and Lonnie Kim, I'm James Min. And seasons, until we meet again.
Season's greetings. Happy New Year. See you next year.
See ya.
See you next year.
Aloha, oi.
Aloha.
As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI, APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.